This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Erev Tov. Welcome to Pardes. We are delighted to see so many people here, and I think everybody's found a seat, more or less. So we're very pleased about that. I'd like to welcome you all to Machon Pardes. My name is Alex Israel, and I run the community education program here and the evening lectures. And I hope you'll pay attention. On the seats, there were flyers for our Leil Shavuot program. So I'd like everybody to take a look and to check out the wonderful array of shiurim that we'll be offering on the night of Shavuot. I'd also like to announce that this time next week, there's another lecture here with Ilana Korshan, who's the author of If All the Seas Were Ink, about her experience of her own personal journey through Daf Yomi and through the ups and downs of life. And we're very excited to have her here next week, so you're all welcome to return. We are celebrating tonight a very special bar mitzvah. And this is because this is the 13th book which has been published by Rabbi Natan Lopez Cardozo. We say that you must say miksat shivcho lefanav, only a fraction of the praise of somebody in front of him. And I'm just going to quote somebody much greater than myself, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, who said about Rabbi Cardozo that he has emerged as one of the most thoughtful voices in contemporary Judaism. He is a man of deep faith and wide intellectual horizons, unafraid to confront the challenges of the age with the quiet confidence of one who is attuned to the music of eternity. I certainly couldn't have said it better myself. What we're going to be discussing tonight is Jewish law as rebellion. And as somebody said to me this week, they said they've heard of people who keep halacha, they've heard of people who rebel against Jewish law, but they've never heard that halacha can itself be rebellion. And therefore, we're going to really hear a wonderfully interesting perspective tonight. I'm sure many of you follow Rabbi Cardozo on his articles online, and you're all invited to sign up for those articles and to buy the book. We have it here to be signed and sold after the lecture. But we all know that Rabbi Cardozo, coming from where he comes from, coming from the depths and inner room of Orthodoxy, has been looking widely and trying to really see the challenges of the age. And what the age we live in demands of us as responsible Jews. And therefore, we're really, really delighted here at Pardes now to be able to welcome Rabbi Natan Lopez Cardozo. Thank
you. Erev Tov, everybody. Can you hear me? Yes, good. First of all, my thanks to Pardes for making this evening possible. Thank you for coming. I didn't expect as many people as this, so that is a great compliment, a great machmaa. I want to thank Alex for arranging this and for introducing me. I also want to thank Emma. And I want to thank Michael Pomerantz, who is outside selling the book. And as you probably know, you will not be able to get out of this building without buying the book, because there's a mishtara shoter standing downstairs. Friends, I want to start with a quote which was sent to me today, which is perhaps a nice introduction to this book. I read you the quote. A group of hikers in the 1920s, led by Professor Se'ef Vilnai, famous man years ago, descended from the hills of Moab and approached the Bay of Shlomo. He pointed out Rash Rash and said, to the people standing around him, "Here will arise a Jewish city." And they replied, "You are crazy." Vilnai, the professor, had the last word. In Zionism, there are special rules. The sane make hysteria, and the insane make hysteria. The sane make hysteria, and the insane make hysteria. Some people will say that this book is insane. And I take it as a compliment. Because it is within the tradition of Zionism and in the tradition of the Jewish tradition. Now, you should know I have introduced this book now several times in different audiences throughout the country. And today you have to be very careful about it, because if you start repeating yourself from what you said last time, somebody will tell you, "I already heard this on the website or on the video." So every time when I have to think about speaking to an audience like yours, I will have to do this in a different way. We just celebrated the 70th birthday of this beautiful country of ours, Medinat Yisrael, the State of Israel. The highlight of our lives for the last 2,000 years. We all know that this place is a complete miracle from one side to the next. After 2,000 years, we returned home. After a Holocaust which cost us 6 million people. And here we are. That because of that reason we irritate the world is very well understood. We have tremendous challenges this very day. We have constant war in this country. I've been myself as a soldier involved in this. We have, badly enough, a lot of infighting. We have corruption. We have terrorist attacks. We have refugee problems. We have poverty problems. I can make a long list. And if I think about it, and the 25,000, about 25,000 soldiers who lost their lives fighting for this state, and each one of us, and each one of them, is like a child to us. I just want to remind you of an observation made by a student of mine, which does not take away from the enormity of this tragedy, but it is important to remember. 25,000 soldiers is less than one day Auschwitz. It's less than one day in Auschwitz. That's an important matter to remember. Because we keep, even with all these losses, we keep this miracle going. Or better, it is kept up for us. We have loads of problems in this country. One of them is the identity of this state. Is this a Jewish state? Is this a state for Jews? Is it a state for all citizens? Should it be a religious state? Should it be a secular state? Should it be democracy? We have modern Orthodox, we have Haredi Orthodox, we have secular Jews, we have reform, we have conservative, humanistic, Jewish values, and so on. And then we have this huge problem called democracy versus the Jewish tradition. You have to remember one thing. Nobody in the last 2,000 years, up till 200 years ago, ever thought about a Jewish state which was basically to be secular and deeply influenced by the Jewish tradition. There is, as far as I know, Nobody who ever wrote about this, not Maimonides, not Rabbi Yosef Karo, the man who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, nobody thought of this possibility. They wrote about the Jewish tradition from the perspective of galut, of living in exile, or, like the Rambam, Maimonides does, in the Messianic days. But this part of our history, where we are not living in the Messianic age, hopefully we will soon do. The Mashiach has not yet come. And on the other side, having the fact that we are neither living anymore in Galut, like our grandparents did and many of us did, that is a phenomenon, a novelty, which nobody thought about. And that has kept and is keeping tremendous pressure on the Jewish tradition. Because where are we going to find the sources, the resources, to deal with a secular Jewish state which is religiously Jewish? The pressure is enormous. We nearly read about it every day in the different papers around this country, in Ivrit, or for that reason in English. And it's resulted in an ambiguous situation. We did not make up our mind what this state is really all about. Jewish, secular, halachic, and whatever other possibilities there are. And what did we do? We did something very intelligent, but not without problems. And that is that we went for what I call the short-term solutions. We are, as Israelis, very good in solving problems on a short term. Whenever there is a problem, we'll try to somehow respond to that and solve it. But we are not very good in long-term solutions. Probably because we didn't have the time yet and because it is much more difficult. Israel's canny ability to deal with the short-term problems, you can see in many ways. How we deal with war. Whenever we are attacked, we come up with new solutions how to defeat the enemy. The arrow, the Iron Dome. When Qassams come down on us, we find also ways. We have technology to find the different tunnels built by our enemies. And we keep on doing that, and we're doing this very, very well. But when it comes to the long-term solutions, there is little of that. Peace with our neighbors is still very far, and we do not yet know at all how we are going to pull that off. Our poverty is still tremendous in this country. Infighting, I don't want even to speak about. The enormous tensions between the Reform, conservative, orthodox, secular, it is all still there, and it hasn't changed much in all these years. I live for 42 years in this country, and while this country has done everything, this they did not solve. Perhaps it is asking too much. What we did do is something else. In halacha, we find actually the same issue, the same problem. Halachic solutions, which no doubt are around everywhere, are always short-term solutions, not long-term solutions. We'll find a problem for the aguna here and there. We'll find a problem for a mamzer problem. We find problems or we find solutions to Shabbat observance. We have a lot of them. But you have to realize what that means. What we are doing over here, like also we do this in the army, these are short-term solutions. We use plasters. We have a problem, we put a plaster over it, we take an aspirin, and we move on. But it doesn't solve the larger problems, the halachic larger problems. There are no, at this moment, real long-term solutions. And that's why I wrote this book, to suggest some of them. Now that I look back to the book and read it myself again, I'm telling myself it did not go far enough. It is still too conventional. Others are very annoyed with me for having written this book because it is overly non-conventional. It all depends where you stand. I don't know if you read, my good friend David Rosenbaum wrote a nice critique and book review in the Jerusalem Post a few weeks ago about this book. And he made an important point, which I accept. There are no doubt great rabbis around who have done a lot to solve problems like Aguna, Mamzer, and so on. He mentioned two or three of them. Our famous Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, Rabbi Nachum Rabinowitz, and perhaps in a different way, Lord Jonathan Sacks. But, and I say this with the greatest amount of respect, and they are much bigger Talmidei Chachamim than I am, all what they did, and it's most important, don't underestimate it, were solving short-term solutions. Creating solutions to short issues which for now work. What I'm trying to do is to suggest something on the long-term level. Not easy, because the material to be used here requires us very often to make or to move it beyond its original meaning to make that possible. The only person who I know of who really did that was a man who I incredibly admire. I never met him, but I've read all his books and you've heard about him. And that was Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, who should get much more attention than he actually does. May his memory be a blessing. Because he understood that there were things which we really have to solve on a long-term basis, which had not been solved and will not be solved unless we take a different stand on matters. But in the meantime, after I'd written and published this book, I found an other remarkable man. You may have heard about that. He's not very much known. By the name of Rabbi Moshe Shmuel Glasner, who lived in the 19th century from 1856 till 1924. He was the chief rabbi of Klausenburg in Hungary. He was a Gadol Hador. He was one of the great poskim of his time, halachic decision makers of that time. He was the great grandson of the Chatam Sofer, who I'm sure you've all heard about. And he was a friend with people of the caliber like Reb Chaim Ozer Grodzinski, the Meshech Chochma, and Rav Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, the famous Rabbi Kuk. And he was highly controversial because he was a Haredi, if that's the right word to use, who was a very strong Zionist and constantly spoke about the need for the Jews in Europe to move as fast as possible to Israel. And therefore he made a lot of enemies. He held many other great rabbis of these days responsible for not having pushed the idea of Zionism within that religious world of that day. And he believed it was a huge halachic mistake not to have done so. He was not reform. He was not conservative. He was not modern orthodox or anything like that. He basically was a Haredi Jew. But what he had to say was absolutely outstanding and mind-boggling. And it has a lot to do with the book which I wrote. He wrote many books, but one stands out. It is called Dor Revi'i. And that is a Pirush, a commentary which he wrote on Masechet Chulin about Shchita, about Trefot, and about many other matters related to Kashrut. And there in his Hakdama, in his introduction, he writes the most remarkable things, which, I must be honest, I was a little shocked when I read it, because it is so unconventional, but it fits me so well that I need to mention him over here. He says, he asks the question, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He, divide the Torah in two parts? The Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, the five books, and what we call the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah. And his contention there is that the purpose of the Torah Shebaal Peh, of the oral Torah, is to allow the sages of each generation, with the emphasis on the word each generation, to adapt the halakha to contemporary circumstances. It was originally, as you all know, forbidden to write the oral Torah down. And even, he writes, when in the days of the Sanhedrin, hear this, the Sanhedrin made statement halachic decisions, he says it is very clear, if you carefully look into all the sukkiot in the Talmud and in the Mishnah and other authoritative texts, that when a Sanhedrin made a decision, the next Sanhedrin was capable of overturning all of these decisions. The generation had to keep to what that Sanhedrin at that time said. But if the Sanhedrin of the next generation had a totally different understanding of it, they did not go back to what a generation earlier was said. They said, no, we are now the ones to decide. As the Torah says, as you all know, you shall listen to your teachers, to the sages of your days. B'yamim ha'elu. Ha'im. And then he continues and he says something remarkable. And to be honest, I have not yet completely understood what he is trying to say. The language is sometimes very difficult. He says the truth about it is there are nearly no rules concerning the interpretation of the Chumash of the Torah, because these rules have every time again to be made by the generation which is at life at that moment. Now that is a very drastic statement to make, right? But that is what he seems to do. He says there may have been minimal amounts of rules which you have to apply to the Torah to come to halachic conclusions. But the vast majority of all these cases are depending on the insight of the sages of that moment and that time. And if they do not agree with an earlier generation, even about these rules, then they have the right to overrule these rules and go their way, because they feel in that way they are able to indeed focus and to adapt the halakha to the new circumstances. And then something, says this great rabbi, happened. Something terrible. And you know what that is? The Mishnah. That was a terrible moment within Jewish history. Now, who dares to say something like that? He didn't care, because he believed that he was telling the truth. Why? He says, because the truth is that the moment that the Mishnah was written, it became authoritative. It therefore was the one to rule on nearly every matter. Later the Gemara continued, obviously, to do that, the Talmud. And therefore, there was no longer the possibility of disputing the Mishnah and its rulings. It now became fixed. It became somehow codified. And therefore, because because of the circumstances, hear well what I say, while living in exile, where Jews had to keep together and there was a need for conformity and therefore rules had to be made which would apply to everybody, we basically did away with the spirit of what the Torah Sheba'al Peh is all about. It had to be done. Why? Because we would not have survived without it. Conformity becomes an incredibly important thing when you're living outside the land of Israel and you're a minority. If you want to survive, you better make sure that we all keep to the same rules. But if you ask the question, is this Torah Sheba'al Peh in its authentic sense of the word? The answer, says the rabbi, is no. It should not have happened. He doesn't hold it against Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi that he did, but he said it was a bedi'evet. It was only an kind of way by which we were able to survive, but at the same time it undermined the very concept of what Torah is all about. Later on, the sages in the days of the Talmud then started indeed to work on the Mishnah because they clearly saw the danger, making things final, creating authority, and therefore not the opportunity of continuing to move forward in according to the original idea. So he says, for example, you all know this very famous principle in our Talmud, Eit la'asot la'shem hefiro toraticha, which means to say that sometimes we have to overrule a law of the Torah because that's the only way how we can keep the Torah alive. Says the rabbi, you must understand, that was only after this codification called the Mishnah. It was a way out to overcome the biggest problems because the codification stood in the way. And therefore, sometimes, when really it was necessary, we had to make use of that rule and gave us the permission to do so. But he says, in the earlier situation, every generation was allowed to do that. Every generation was able to sit down, obviously with lots of knowledge, with a tremendous amount of integrity, with an enormous amount of Yirat Shamayim, very important, the last one, and would reinterpretate the Torah in according to what they understood would be the correct response to the new circumstances. But that did not happen. I give you one example out of the many examples he shows. You all know the famous, what we call in Latin, the rule of lex talionis, which is to say eye for eye, tooth for tooth, and so on. Everybody knows that the sages understood that to mean monetary compensation. Tashlumim. That's the way how the Talmud discusses it. And the Rambam, interestingly enough, states that this is one of the cases where we have a ruling since the days of Har Sinai, the revelation at Sinai, that the meaning of this word, ayin tachat ayin, eye for eye, means monetary compensation. Says the rabbi, I am not so sure that this is true. Why? Because if you look in the Gemara in Bava Kamma, you will see over there, if you want to look it up, in 83b, you will see that there is a discussion whether or not to understand it that way as the sages ultimately decided. Which means, in according to Rabbi Klasner, there were people who took that more literally or had a completely different interpretation of that. And it was only in the days of the Talmud or in the days of the Mishnah that they came to a conclusion that it meant monetary compensation. But this was not coming down from Sinai. That's what he says. A tremendous chidush in every sense of the word. And he says, even, and now it comes to the interesting point, even when it did come down from Sinai, that does not mean that we continuously have to accept it that way, because we have another principle, which you all know, Torah lo bashamayim. The Torah is not from heaven, and it is depending on the sages how to understand it, which he seems to imply that even when there was an original ruling coming down from Sinai that it meant, in our case, monetary compensation, the later synod generation still had the right to say, but we understand it differently, and they would go against the official tradition. Now, my friends, when I saw this, I nearly fainted. But I remember, or better, I remind you of the fact that we are speaking here about a Haredi, tremendous Talmid Chacham, who could not care less about what other people said and just believed in what he wrote so that it would be possible to move the Torah forwards as the only way how to make halakha relevant to the new conditions. What then is the Mishnah? The Mishnah is an emergency measurement for the time, so that indeed we will overcome our enemies by living in exile, by making sure that we live in some kind of conformity, but it is far from ideal, and it was never the original ideology or the original purpose of why we have a Torah Shebaal Peh, because the Torah Shebaal Peh must stay oral. And every moment that we write something of it down, we are violating that principle that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi did so because of the circumstances at the time when we went into exile is understandable. But now comes the point which the rabbi is making, and which, by the way, Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz also makes, and that is, does that still apply today in our totally different circumstances, namely the state of Israel? We are out of exile. It is true the Mashiach has not yet come, and nobody is mentioning here that we should do away with the Mishnah just like that, but that we have much more and many greater opportunities now because of the new circumstances will have to be admitted to. And we will have to rethink many of these matters so that we can make sure that the halakha stays a living organism within Israeli society. This is most important. And my dear friends, that is something which I tried to convey within my book. Not enough, looking back now, to the book. I should have given it more attention, but I realize that no doubt the great rabbi here has done something very remarkable. And then he says something else. Also very remarkable and very much debated today in our religious society. He says, you must understand that we can only apply halakha in according to the ethical principles of the days in which we live. That is to say, that if the, forgive me for saying so, and I only do that once, when the goyim, the Gentiles, have a particular moral principle which they have developed over the years, whether they keep to it or they do not keep to it, but became part of civilization, then we must treat it as if that is halakha. And we cannot say something like, well, the halakha says like this, and secular morality says like that, which many rabbis have been saying and are still saying. He was of the opinion that that is not true. And I understand him to say that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts into the minds of the Gentile world great principles of ethics, then this is something which is also min hashamayim, and we will have to incorporate that within our halachic system. And if we not do that, then we are violating another principle in the halacha, which you all know about, the Gemara in Sanhedrin 59a, where the Talmud discusses the question whether or not something which is forbidden to the non-Jews can be permitted to us. Something which is forbidden to them, long sukya, I shall not go into this now, which or is part of the Sheva mitzvot shel b'nei Noach, the Seven Commandments or Noah, or one of the Totsaot of these Seven Commandments, then that moment, he says, it is clear from the Talmud that we are not allowed to say that something can be permitted to us which is forbidden to them. Meaning, we will have to take into account, while we are building halakha for today, we have to keep into account what is being said in the non-Jewish world about ethical issues. And if you know anything about ethical philosophy, then you know that a lot has been said about it. Again, the question whether or not they live up to it is a whole different issue, but it definitely has developed. And therefore, things which may have been permitted to us in the past can no longer be permitted now to us anymore, because the non-Jews basically have a different principle and we will have to live by that. I give you one example. He gives loads of examples. Perhaps a little complicated, and I will make it very simple. And that is that, for example, the Talmud says that if somebody is very ill and he needs to eat non-kosher food, what is better? To eat nevela, which means meat from a dead animal, it's died, found somewhere in the desert, or to eat from tevel, which is a kind of agricultural law, I shall not go into this, or chelef, which is fat which we are not allowed to eat, where the Talmud says that we should eat the nevela. Says Rabbi, this great Rabbi Glasner, he says, yes, but that is no longer possible, because if nevela is now forbidden in the non-Jewish world, no person is going to eat from meat which is found dead somewhere in the desert, which no doubt a long time ago they did, but it would be completely repulsive to do anything like that. We can no longer allow this, even when somebody is in great danger, to allow him to permit that. Why? Because the non-Jewish world no longer accepts this as a possibility. And then he takes it even a step further. Another example. As I'm sure you all know, the Mishnah makes it very clear that if a fire breaks out on Shabbat in your home, you cannot extinguish it. Unless it is sakanat nefashot. Unless it is a matter of life and death. But if it is not, then you have to let your whole home just burn down. The Rama, Rabbi Moshe Izalis, in the Shulchan Aruch says, yes, that is true, but if it is in a non-Jewish town where the non-Jews will get upset with us for allowing our home to completely burn down, probably bringing them into danger as well, you are allowed to do that. Why? The reason is because we are otherwise getting ourselves into major problems with the non-Jewish world, anti-Semitic attacks and so on, and therefore we are allowed to do that. But the principle is that you are not allowed to do this. Ask Rabbi Glasner, so what happens in a case when this happens in a Jewish town, in Tel Aviv, God forbid, or Jerusalem, where there are no non-Jews? Should we then let the whole thing, and if necessary, let the whole city burn down because we are not allowed to violate the Shabbat? And he writes over there very carefully, Ze tzarich ayin gadol. It needs very careful contemplation. Why? He says, because I have another principle. I do not believe, he seems to say, that we have to have the whole city burning down even when there are only Jews there. Why? And then he comes with the following chidush. He says, people who have a home and it burns down, which is their property, and because of that, they will live afterwards in complete, constant poverty for the rest of their lives, because all what they have was their home, which is not worth a penny anymore. That kind of living is so terrible, is such a torment, is so painful, that he believes that that is worse than to die. In other words, The very fact that a human being and a Jew is living under impossible financial circumstances so that he is not able to live a normal, respectful life anymore, that is all on the level of Sakanat Nefashot, if not more than that. And therefore he says, it needs a lot of understanding what will happen in a Jewish state city here in Israel, and God forbid something like that will happen. And he seems to indicate that we should definitely extinguish the fire even when there is not a non-Jew around anywhere and everywhere. My dear friends, these are great chidushim. And this great rabbi is prepared to write them down, and you can quite well imagine how much opposition he got when he started to write this down. The only difference is that since he was such a tremendous Talmid Chacham, nobody just like that could just wave him aside. He was a man who was completely part of the Haredi Orthodox world, who was writing this, L'shem Shamayim, no doubt. And he says himself, I'm prepared to listen to anybody who does not agree with me, but come up with good arguments to show me that I'm wrong. What he is saying, and much in my book is about this, is that the halakha, and I use here a terminology, the terminology of Rabbi Berkowitz, went into a waiting mode. The moment that we left Eretz Yisrael 2,000 years ago, and we had to go into exile, halakha could not develop a normal, organic way. Why not? Because if you are a minority living among much of an anti-Semitic world, your first and most important matara, your very purpose now is, how do we survive exile? That becomes the overall ruling. We have to make sure that we stay alive. And if that means to say that we have to build high walls around us, to keep the non-Jewish world outside, to make sure that our children don't get influenced by that world, and because of that we will be able to survive, we have to do that. And that is the point of departure of the Mishnah, and to a great extent of the Gemara, of the Talmud. What is happening now is that the whole of the halakha moves in a different direction than what was originally planned, or what was originally the whole purpose behind it, an organic kind of halakha which would move forward, but can only do that when Jews are living in their own country, like we are doing today. So says Rabbi Berkowitz, the halakha became what he calls defensive. It constantly put everything away which could be of danger to us, physically, spiritually. And indeed, it cannot be denied that the rabbis there did a great job, because they managed to get us through these 2,000 years without giving up and without completely disappearing. And the very fact that we did not disappear for the last 2,000 years is one of the greatest miracles in all of human history. A small little nation, which does not even make up 1% of mankind, manages to outdo all its enemies, stands up against the Roman Empire, the Egyptians, the Germans, the Persians, and so on and so on. And we manage to do that, there is no doubt about that, only because we lived a life of halakha, and that halakha had to be a halakha which was defensive, so to make possible that we would survive. But once that had happened, and we came back to the land of Israel in 1948, and even so, this is not yet a country of the Messianic age, and lots of things are not the way as we would like to see them, the fact is that the big question needs to be asked, can we then continue to use that very halakha which developed for 2,000 years in exile and just use it on the state of Israel as if nothing has happened? And this is the problem of the establishment, the rabbinical establishment here in Israel. What are we going to do now? Can we just continue like we did when we were in Spain, when we were in Poland, when we were in all the other countries? Or do we really have to rethink this whole thing over in the way that Rabbi Berkowitz and the other rabbi did, so that we will be able to make that halakha to work in a way that it would respond to the new circumstances, which are radically different from anything which we have had in the last 2,000 years. But in the meantime, more problems came up. Understandable. One of them, and I discussed that in great length in my book, is the codification of Jewish law by Maimonides. A most remarkable work, the Mishneh Torah. A genius work. There's no other word for it. If you just think about the fact that we know that Maimonides wrote the Mishneh Torah between one patient and the next, as a doctor, and every time he wrote a few halachot down, and out of that came the Mishneh Torah, which I believe you now need 500 rabbis their whole life to write something similar to that, then we know what we are speaking about. Genius. But from the perspective of these rabbis, a mistake. Not a mistake that they wrote it down, but to try to codify Jewish law and to say this is the final decision is a mistake. What is even very interesting and very unusual, Maimonides writes at the beginning, the Hakdamah to his Mishneh Torah, that now that there is a Mishneh Torah, there's really no need anymore to learn Talmud. I don't know what to do with that, to be quite honest. How could he have written that? What was the purpose behind that, by making that statement? And Baruch Hashem, we did not listen to him. Because if there's something beautiful about the Talmud, it is this. The Talmud is a complete impossible text. I come from a completely secular background, as you all know. And when for the first time I had to learn or try to learn a little bit of Talmud, in my days there was no Sonsino, there was no Art Scroll, there was just something in German. I know German, so I read the German. It's just very hard to understand what actually went on. But what I straight away picked up, my dear friends, was that this very Talmud is a most remarkable thing because it is an encyclopedia of the Jewish tradition and of Jewish law with one difference. There is no A, B, C, D. Everything is completely chaotic. This is the only right word for this. It's complete chaos within the Talmud. It jumps from one place to the next. You don't know if you turn the page what now will happen again. But that, my dear friends, is so marvelous about it. Because what that means is that the Talmud is alive. Because our lives are, to a very great extent, chaotic. You cannot work out your life from now till the end in 120 years in according to all the different rulings of A, B, C. There is no such thing. And therefore the Talmud was not prepared to go into this now. It is a complete mess, a balagan in the Talmud. But that is exactly the beauty of it. Have you ever thought about the following fact? That there are moments when the Talmud discusses matters related to legal issues, damage, payments which have to be made, and then you turn around the page and there is a discussion about the way how a woman should seduce her husband in the bathroom. For a small fee, I will tell you where you can find it. And then a moment later, it goes back to the original discussion. And every yeshiva bocher learns this. I remember I learned it. You don't even realize what happening because you're reading it in Hebrew or in Aramaic. And it is obviously a Talmudic debate full of kedusha, full of holiness. But this is what is going on. How are you going to codify anything like this? There is no way of doing this. And that's the beauty. Therefore, learning Talmud for me till this very day is a tremendous pleasure, because I like to be shocked. I like to live in a balagan. I like to know what may or may not happen the next page. Who knows? This full of incredible lachats, which is basically put on you, and therefore this right alive. And Maimonides, who tried to make the ABCD, which he did, by the way, in a marvelous way, really marvelous way, he was basically busy being a Greek thinker in doing that. Greek philosophy is carefully built up step by step. Very powerful. Very beautiful. There's nothing of that in the Talmud. But the truth is that Maimonides, because he was, after all, forgive me for saying this, a deeply religious Jew, but in his thinking he was a Greek philosopher and not a Jewish philosopher. Therefore he built it the way as he did. And we, all of us, have tremendous, tremendous help when we learn Talmud, when we read what Maimonides writes about the Talmud. I read him not because I want to know what the halakha is. I want to know how did that man learn the Talmud, this particular sukya, this particular part of the Talmud, which very often is totally different from Rashi and from Tosafot and from others, because he was a tremendously independent mind. And then you have the Shulchan Aruch, the Codex of Jewish Law, many hundreds of years later, of Rabbi Yosef Karo, which is even more limited because it doesn't even speak anymore about anything of Israel, only about what is happening in Galut, in exile. Remarkable work, no doubt. But how are you going to apply that on the state of Israel? How are you going to apply that on a whole different circumstances? It doesn't work anymore. And therefore, we need a different way of looking to the halakha to make sure that we will make sure that the halakha stays at the center of our living. Nothing is more important than that. And that requires that we have to look to all of this a little different. A little much different. There's a very famous observation made by the Maharashal, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, of the 16th century, when he says the following about the Talmud. I read in a translation. One should never be astonished by the range of debate and argumentations in the matter of halakha. All these views, even when they oppose each other, are in the category of Elu ve Elu Divrei Elokim Chayim. These and those are the words of the living God. And they all came down to us from Sinai. The Kabbalists, the Mekubalim, explained that the basis for this is that each individual soul, hear this, was present at Sinai and received the Torah by means of 49 tzinorot, which means an infinite amount of different spiritual channels. Each one perceived the Torah from his own perspective in accordance with the intellectual capacity and in according to the uniqueness of his particular soul. So therefore, it could be possible that for one person it meant this, and for another person it meant that. That's the meaning of Elu ve Elu Divrei Elokim Chayim. These and those are the words of the living God. But you know what that means, to put it in more modern terms? It means this. There are no passive recipients within the halakha. It is not that you and I sit in front of the halakha and it just comes to us and that's it. No, I have to take it in. I have to consume it. I have to make it part of my very existence. I have to get it into my neshama, into my soul, which means to say that I read it in a particular way and my neighbor next door does not read it like that. And therefore, it is a very particular and a very individual kind of understanding of what Torah min hashamayim means, Torah from heaven means, and how I live my halachic life. The Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam and the Mishnah cannot do that for us. We will have to do that ourselves. When we are not having enough knowledge, when we are not sure, we may ask our rabbis to help us out. But we should not make the mistake to leave the whole thing in the hands of the rabbis and say, they tell us what to do. No, you will have to incorporate that into your very being, like a person who is playing music, a piece of Mozart, Beethoven, and so on, cannot just play Beethoven. He cannot just play Mozart. He will have to borrow the notes of Mozart and Beethoven and Paganini to make it his own music. Ask any great musician and he will tell you how true that is. And so it is true about halacha. We somehow forgot that. For reasons which have to do with exile. For reasons which have to do with our very uncomfortable and artificial situation in which we found ourselves the last 2,000 years. And then one more point to be made. And that is this. We have to realize that the whole concept of halacha is basically to be rebellious. What do I mean by that? The meaning of this is that what Jewish law has been doing, in reality, at least that's the way how I read it, and you may disagree with me, the point is the following. The halakha is there to disturb you. It is something which needs to protest, which is a rebellion. Against what? Against the way how you and I include myself into this, live our lives by complacency, by frumkeit, to use that beautiful Yiddish word, by self-indulging kinds of practices, very often insensitivity, conformity for the sake of conformity, without ever having a religious experience and feeling God close to us. The meaning of the halakha is to make us aware that every moment in which we live is a moment of total amazement, of a wow, of saying, how is life absolutely impossible to understand unless I'm open to the concept of amazement, of wonder, of being aware that all this is a big and huge mysterium in which we live. And no scientist in this world is going to explain it for us. That's neither the purpose of science. But we have forgotten it. And forgive me for saying that. And what now has happened is that we have made halakha into idol worship. It now became our ultimate objective. As long as I live in according to the halakha, whether it is the Shulchan Aruch or it is the Mishnah Berurah of the holy Chafetz Chaim, as long as I do that, I'm fine. My dear friends, I'm sorry to tell you, you are not fine. Because that's not the purpose of it. The purpose is to wake you up, to disturb you. Somebody once said, actually I should mention his name, very controversial person, Louis Jacobs. I'm sure some of you have heard about him. Tremendous Talmid Chacham, with all the controversy around him, I shall not go into this now, who once said, for many hundreds of years we have used religion to make people feeling comfortable. Now the purpose of his religion is to make people uncomfortable, to shock us, to make us aware that this cannot continue like that, because there's one thing you have to realize, my dear friends. You will not be able to inspire your children by living by the Mishnah Berurah or the Shulchan Aruch unless you make them aware that they are part of a tradition of rebellion. Shabbat is a rebellion. Eating kosher is a rebellion. Taharat HaMishpacha, living by the laws of family purity, is a rebellion against the obsessions of the world in which we are surrounded today. But who of us is still aware of that? Who of us is still prepared to go this way, because it is not an easy way and it can be very painful? But if we want to inspire our children, and many of us have great problems in that, because after all there is so much around us which is so interesting to our children, how are we going to keep that Jewish tradition alive in their hearts? Then the answer to that is, my dear friends, If you teach it in a different way and you make them aware that they are part of a tremendous mission, a mission of rebellion or a mission of protest, you're able to bring them back to the Jewish tradition. But that you will have to do on your own and in the best way possible, which is very far from easy. My dear friends, my hour, I suppose, is over. Yes, it indeed is. I would have had and like to speak another 5 hours, but there is no chance that the Pardes will allow me to do this. Let me just say the following. I give you a few examples, and that is where I will finish my observations. People ask me, obviously, so what le ma'aseh do we need to do? And it's not such an easy one to answer, because we have to create a different hashkafa. We have to make our children to understand that the halakha is something totally different from what they often hear at school or by you and by me at home. I often have bachurei yeshiva eating Friday night at my table. I ask them the following. Tell me, how many masechtot did you learn? How many Talmudic tractates did you learn? How many years were in your yeshiva? 4 years, 5 years. Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, Sanhedrin, and so on. Fantastic. Now let me ask you one question. If a non-religious Jew, or a less religious Jew, or a non-Jew, a Gentile, will come to you and ask you the one question, simple question, my dear friends, why are you religious? What would you answer? 99.9% does not know how to answer that question. And then I say to them, and you learned all of Baba Kama, Baba Batra, Baba Metzia, Brachot, and all the awesome Masechtot, and you can't even explain to yourself why you are religious? So what is this all about? And then I go to the Rosh Yeshivot to complain. And then I found out, to my great regret, and I say this really with great regret and pain, they themselves don't know. That's the situation in which we find ourselves. We better wake up. Here are a few suggestions. If you want to pass them on to others, you can do so, but make sure you do it correctly. I'm already enough in trouble. Besides the question about democracy and halakha, which I do not know anybody has really written about it in the past, with the exception perhaps of a Rabbeinu Nissim, the Ran, in Spain many hundreds of years ago. Long story, I shall not go into this now. And obviously, in our days, it was Rav Herzog and a few other great people have tried very hard to bring as much halakha into the secular Israeli system as possible. Long and very complicated story. I would like to remove the Chumra of Rabbi Seira in the Talmud, which makes the days for a young couple to wait before the woman can go to a mikvah and they can have sexual relations again, which could be shortened in according to the halakha if we remove what is called the Chumra of Rabbi Seira. I am, after I've read Rabbi Yosef Mashash, Sephardi rabbi, was the chief rabbi of Haifa, a long, very interesting article, basically saying, do not misunderstand me, that there is no need to build an eruv in most of the cities. Why? To make it very short, because there is no longer a reshut harabim next to these particular cities, which would require the Carmelite. I shall not go into all what this means. For those who know, you know. Then you have to build an eruv. But if there is no such thing as a reshut harabim, a public domain, then there is, in according to the very idea of halakha, no need to build, and you can still carry. Now, I want you to remember well what I say. You should not carry. But not because the halakha says you're not allowed to carry, but because there's a beautiful idea about this not carrying on Shabbat. Even when there is an eruv. I myself, every few weeks, I do not carry one Shabbat to keep the idea that a man one day in his life or one day in the month, He should only carry himself and not all the external things around him. There's tremendous meaning behind that. But halachically speaking, we are spending millions of dollars on building and holding alive our Eruvim in many countries, here in Israel and in Chutz La'aretz. Why not use them for our poor people? Shemitah, I'm all in favor of it. But we should stop it. What I mean to say by that is this. Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz in his book, Ha-Halacha, Kocha V'Tafkida, which is translated in English as well in a short form, argues clearly that there is no need today to keep Shemitah. Definitely not when it costs us and the state of Israel millions of dollars every 7th year. Does that mean that we should do away with Shemitah? God forbid. It means to say that we have to do it differently to keep the idea alive. Every farmer should cut off a little piece of his land and keep Shemitah der Lechumra with all the different requirements. But to have the whole land to be sold to the non-Jews, which to me is an impossible thing to accept, to be quite honest. Or to do it in another way, which is so complicated and costs so much money, while in fact there is no need for this. Giyur, I've written about it in great lengths, conversion in great lengths in my book, and you will see over there all the shocking statements which I will make about that or have made about this, but it is a little different from what we are being told today by the official rabbinical authorities. I'm not even sure anymore, and to be quite honest, I'm a Portuguese-Spanish Jew. I shave in the Omer. I listen to music. Because if you look in the sources, the only time when this comes up as a way that we indeed now know, do not shave and no longer listen to music, only comes up in the Shulchan Aruch and not in earlier codifications at all, is not mentioned at all in the Talmud. And I'm asking one question today in the state of Israel, where there is already so much mourning going on for our soldiers, for the Shoah, do we really need to continue with this? I just asked the question. Tisha B'Av, should we not do this a little different? How can I, and I've written about this for those who remember, how can it be that I have to read Eicha, where I state that I'm living in a city which is completely destroyed when I look out of the window and I see the most beautiful parks and my children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are walking and playing around over there? How can I continue to say Eicha? Do I fast on Tisha B'Av? Yes, because it is a terrible thing that we don't have a temple. But the situation has changed. Why not confronting this the way as it should? Our tefillot, which we say in the shul, are often said much too fast, without having an opportunity to think about what we are saying. And we should really do something about it. There are halachic rulings for that, how to do that. But it needs to be done. And if you remember, I wrote also a long time ago in the Jerusalem Post an article where I said, why do we not allow people to use bicycles on Shabbat? Because there's really no reason at all why we shouldn't do that. The Ben Ishchai, one of the great, great poskim of the Sephardi world, clearly states that there's nothing why we should not make use of bicycles. And if you go to the Syrian community in Brooklyn, then you will see everybody cycling Orthodox Jews on Shabbat to Shul. And it could be an enormous help in this country for getting more people to keep Shabbat, which is the ultimate goal. And so on, and so on. I shall not, and I have to stop over here because I promised that I would stay more or less within an hour. I hope you enjoyed what I had to say, and I hope that you will indeed carefully listen to what I and others have said about this, because we have to move forward and to make sure that halacha is part of our deepest experience in our religious lives. Thank you very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.